We're back live with more of the Cubs for a Cure Radiothon, benefiting cancer research in partnership with Stand Up to Cancer and Brain Up.
Hey, this is Ryan Porth, program manager of 670 The Score. I stand up for my guy, former NFL GM Floyd Reese, who died 3 years ago due to a year-long bout with esophageal cancer. I love you, Floyd.
Donate now by texting the phrase CURE24 to 41444. That's CURE24 to 41444.
Okay, we are now at 7 p.m., we are 9 hours into this thing, which means we have 15 hours to go. We have raised over $320,000.
Wow.
100% of that is going to cancer research. That is an amazing thing. The Cubs are going to, so from now until the morning, we've allocated some money. So we're going to still be able to do some dollar-for-dollar matches. $5 becomes $10, $20 becomes $40. So your matches are still getting doubled here, courtesy of Cubs Charities. So keep it going. CURE24 is what you want to text to 41444, CubsForACure.com. CubsForACure.com, text CURE24 to 41444. Aunt Heron in with me for the next couple of hours. And we are thrilled now to be joined by Diane Pathew, the terrific anchor and reporter from ABC7, and her husband, Nick, who is in his own journey with glioblastoma. Diane and Nick, thank you so much for joining us tonight. How are you today?
Oh, we're so happy to be here. This is such a just an awesome experience to be here with you. We're good. It was a long, you know, we talk about the journey. It was a long day at today was infusion.
Yeah.
So, you know, the cancer appointments are, as many people who are going through their own journey, the appointments are plentiful. Let's just say that. And, you know, you just never know how long your day is going to be. You think it's going to be, you know, a few hours. It ends up being almost the entire day. But we're home and it was a good day. It was a really, really good day. Got some MRI results that the doctor is pretty pleased with. You want to go ahead and tell them that, Nick?
Yes. We have a scan and it's clearing up as we speak. So wow. Right now, let's keep it that way. Hopefully everything turns out the way we want.
Man, I remember those infusion days and those scan days that, you know, my sister-in-law Jen would take Brad to, and then the whole family is just anxiously waiting by the phone for what the results of the scans were and how it all went. How do you pass the time? I know Brad had all sorts of things that he would do. What are those days like for you, Diane and Nick?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah, Diane is currently going through school also. So she will watch that, do her stuff there, and I will talk about anything in the world just to get my mind off the cancer.
So we do like really, it's funny because people must think, people like the nurses at the infusion place must think we're so strange because we get into the deepest discussions when we're in this like little space. And, but no, we just like, we'll pass the time by talking to each other. I mean, you know, I know a lot of people like bring decks of cards and stuff. We've never needed to do that because we've always, it's almost like our catch-up sessions, if that makes sense. Like, let's go over everything we just learned this week and what do we want to talk about? How do we want to tackle the next couple of appointments and stuff like that? And Nick is in rehab, like pretty intense rehab right now, 3 hours a day, 3 days a week. And so we talk about, do we think it's going well? And what can you do today? I mean, it's just like, I think it's our catch-up session is how we treat infusion days.
Yeah, for sure.
And when you have that opportunity to not only spend time with each other, but any of us who've spent extensive time in hospitals, medical facilities, rehab facilities, treatment centers, when you're, you know, you're not only there together and with your loved ones, but then there's a little bit of a community that can often develop between you and the medical staff or you and other patients or other people receiving treatment around those same times. What have your observations been of that? What type of community develops when you're in the midst of that?
One of the things we recently went to was Rush held what they call Survivor's Day, and it was an entire Sunday morning into the early afternoon dedicated to just survivors and thrivers. So it wasn't just people who are done with their journey, but people who are smack dab in the middle of it. You want to talk about a community. I mean, we were there and we met so many people that had their own story to share. So they, you know, you hear their story, you tell them your story, and then it just becomes, you know, the two cancer patients are just like, oh yeah, no. And then I did this. Oh yeah, I did that too. And it's like, they share these stories that only somebody who has cancer or is, you know, close with somebody that has cancer would understand. So it's almost like a different language that everybody's speaking, but like everybody in that space had a story to tell. And it was one of the most fulfilling events we've covered this year, or we've been to this year. And it's just so meaningful to hear those stories. And then when you're there in the infusion room, for example, the one we went to today, the curtains were all, everybody's curtains were all open. So everybody was kind of like speaking aloud and like laughing with each other. And it was just, it's just like a little neighborhood.
Text CURE24 to 41444. Diane Pathew and her husband, Nick. Nick going through his journey with glioblastoma right now. CubsForACure.com. It's the same thing that my brother had. You know, Diane, we have these public jobs and we have these platforms. And then these people that we love more than anything else in our lives get this terrible diagnosis. I know it was a conversation with Brad and I about being public about it and talking about it. And he was all in, and he came on the show a few times and, you know, told his story and updated people on his social media and all that. What has it been like for you? Because, I mean, I follow you on Instagram and I see you on Channel 7. Like, what has it been like for you and Nick and the decision to kind of be so public with your journey in this diagnosis?
So that decision didn't come until 2 years after his initial diagnosis, or maybe just shy of 2 years. One day, Nick just woke up. It was never going to be my decision, right? So Nick just woke up one day and said, hey, how do you feel about sharing my story? And of course, my ears perked and I'm like, well, tell me more. Why are you feeling this way? What do you want to do? Like, what's your goal? And, you know, Nick is a former Milwaukee firefighter, and I always call him my hero because, I mean, that was his bread and butter. That's all he knew how to do, is to be a hero, is to step in and save others. And he said to me, I really want to tell and share my story. And I want to share like the good, bad, and the ugly, because I don't want people to feel like, one, they're alone, and two, they have nobody else to turn to. I want them to know that, hey, I'm a young person who got this quote unquote rare old person disease or old person cancer. And I'm going to publicly share my journey with you so that you can come to me if you need help or somebody to talk to. And the response has just been tremendous. He was diagnosed at the end of 2020, December 2020. But since then, we've heard from hundreds is an understatement.
Around the world. It's amazing.
Yeah. And people have reached out. People reach out to you every day, right? I mean, yes. That's a fair statement.
Yes. The only thing, sometimes there's a language barrier. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to understand what's happening. So I try to help as much as I can. Yeah.
So that was the goal, was for him to help others. Mm-hmm. And I think in turn for Nick, that's what feeds his soul. He's the type of person that he only feels better about himself, and correct me if I'm wrong, when he's helping others. That gives him, I think, a great satisfaction and a great zest to make it through the next day and keep on fighting, right?
Yeah, I mean, you get involved with people over online.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can see how it happens now. I see so many different things from different angles now. And most of it is positive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then for me too, when we made that decision and I turned to my boss at the time, mm-hmm. and told her all of this, and they were just so supportive and so uplifting. I mean, mm-hmm. they just were doing everything right to make us feel like we were in charge of telling the story and we had our voices heard. And we were loved and respected by everybody. And we felt all of that. And it was just, like I said, it was a big decision to make, one that Nick made out of the blue one day, just kind of woke up and felt this overwhelming feeling. And I think that we're really happy we shared it. I think we're really happy to continue to share it. Sometimes it feels like, does anybody really care about this? And then you make a post and then like hundreds of people respond or reach out to you in some way. And then you're like, okay, well, now I feel better about it because, you know, Amy from wherever needed a doctor to come to, you know, to come visit Chicago and go and see. And we gave her this name. And we've done that so many times to people who are like, hey, we don't live there. Do you think it's worth it for us to come down and do whatever? And we have forwarded them tons of information. I mean, that's just so, it's so gratifying to help others, especially when this is just, this cancer is just such a beast. I always say it's such a beast because it'll attack you when you least expect it and when you're not looking. I mean, it just hits you right upside the head and it's ongoing. It's like, it's just an ongoing battle. And so I think it's been very beneficial for both Nick and I, and hopefully many others that we, that you decided to go public.
Yes. Yeah. And there are these so many different ways to fight this war. Is a glioblastoma is not the same in everybody and is so complicated that it'll make your head spin alone. So it's very, you need people to understand it and everybody needs to be involved. Mm-hmm.
And you're both referencing the story that you're in the midst of right now and the benefits of being able to share that publicly. And so many people end up benefiting from hearing about detection and early signs of detection. Yes. With something like this, because so many of us kind of go through the sort of the daily rigors of life. Like, oh, my shoulder feels like this, or my sleep pattern feels a bit different, but you just sort of work through it. What was the story like for Nick, just in both of you in recognizing that there was something a little deeper going on?
There was nothing. Yeah, there was nothing like that. So unfortunately with glioblastoma and a lot of brain cancers, you don't know you have a growing brain tumor until, nope. And a lot of times it's until it's too late. So in the case of Nick, it was, we were smack dab in the middle of COVID. So it was December of 2020. So I was at work and it was holiday week. It was the week of Christmas. It was like 4 days before Christmas. And I was working on the anchor desk filling in and Nick was working out at home. We had built a little gym downstairs, obviously, because all the gyms were closed at the time. And he was working out as he always does. Now, typically in the morning when he gets up, has his coffee, he sends a text message to me just letting me know like, hey, good morning, love you. I'm good. I'm going to go down and work out, something like that. I didn't get that text message that day, so I thought that was kind of strange. And at the time, my dad was coming to work out with him in the mornings because, again, gyms were closed and my dad and him really got like a rhythm going and they were working out and motivating each other. So he would go down every morning. And I had gotten a text from my dad like, hey, I knocked on the door. It was weird, like all the lights were off and Nick wasn't answering. So I'm just going to go home. And I said, well, wait, don't go home because we just don't oversleep. Like, it's just not a thing. If anything, we wake up 2 hours before the alarm, right? It's just not a thing. So when he said that to me, I immediately, my alarm bells were ringing like, well, what's happening? So I kept texting him, no response, kept calling him, no response. And mind you, I'm on the air while this, so I'm doing this during commercial breaks. It's the most uncomfortable, awkward, you know, situation, right? So finally, I'm like, this is just strange. He calls me back and I'm like, oh, phew, like he's fine. And I said, hey, are you okay? Why aren't you picking up the phone? Why aren't you opening the door? He's like, no, I'm not okay. And I said, what are you talking about? You're not okay. Do you need an ambulance? He's like, yes. And that's all it took. And like, I ripped off my microphone, ripped off my earpiece with, which now looking back, I'm like, I can't believe I did that, but got off the anchor desk. And I mean, when I say, thank goodness there was no traffic, because again, holiday week, middle of COVID, there was no trap. I mean, I made it home in record time and my family had reached him before I did, which is great because they don't live very far away. We had called the ambulance. They had gotten here. And when everybody had gotten here, Nick was just like sitting in his chair in the family room as if nothing had happened. And then, you know, the paramedics were like, so what happened to you? He's like, he somehow managed to say the words like, I had a seizure, right? And he knew he was having one when it was happening because he remembers waking up with his leg in the air and he couldn't process 911. So he kept dialing 911, but then kept hanging up on the dispatcher because he didn't understand how to use the phone at the time. So all these things were happening, but he looked perfectly fine as if nothing had happened. And so when he was rushed to the ambulance or rushed to the hospital and I met him there, again, COVID protocols, right? So I couldn't get in for another like 10, 15 minutes, finally got in there and he looked fine. So I was like, okay, well, this is not a thing. Maybe it was just a fluke. And I said, what did they say is wrong with you? He said, they said brain cancer. And I just rolled my eyes. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's, you know, they exaggerate so much. They just want us to do a bunch of tests. You've never even had as much as a headache. You don't have brain cancer.
Right.
And then it was like the worst slap in the face ever. Because sure enough, he had a large, I think they said just slightly smaller than a softball sized tumor. And it was, you know, grade 4 glioblastoma. And I had never even heard of the term. Now, I had known of the politicians that had passed from it and Joe Biden's son that passed from it. I mean, I knew about it, but didn't know about it. And then it was like, I had to get really smart about it. And so it was just the worst 2 weeks of our lives. I mean, he was in the hospital for 17 days. He had surgery and the surgery went beautifully. Actually, they resected almost all of it. And I thought it was all like, it's done, right? You had the tumor removed. You're done. You're good. No, I mean, this is like the most aggressive cancer and it comes back almost immediately. And we had no idea. And so we were on this journey of trying to figure out what this all means. And, you know, for the next, he went through radiation, you know, standard of care. So chemo radiation. And for the next few months, it really wasn't that bad. I mean, he was doing okay. And even up to a year, almost a year and a half, he was really doing well. And we really thought we were in the clear. And then there was a reoccurrence of the tumor. So that's kind of how everything started. And it's just been kind of fighting since then. But it really was a very big shock to the system because at the time, Nick was, I would say, in the best shape of his life. It was like 6 or 7% body fat, working out every day. I mean, one of the cleanest diets you'd ever seen. We didn't, you know, we don't drink that much and we don't smoke. And it was like in the middle of COVID, he was really concentrating on his health and wellness. And how crazy that during the time when he's the healthiest is when this pops up. So it was just a real reality check. And again, it opened you up to a whole different community of fighters. And it just, the knowledge that you learn both online and from different doctors and patients is just, it's almost like I didn't think I ever wanted to learn so much, but here we are. And, you know, and it continues, like you continue to learn.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Your story reminds me so much of Brad's, just in, I mean, same thing. Healthy as an ox one day, tumor the size of an orange the next, learning about it, doing everything you can, doing a successful surgery, then a recurrence, and then all of the problems that come with the recurrence, and then it stays with you forever. It's a hell of a thing. How do you stay brave, Nick?
I would say brave is not the word. It is, let's keep fighting. Always fight, even if you feel great. Don't let it sneak up on you. Don't give up. Always, always stay, listen to your body. And if not, something's not right, it's not right. And you have to have support. Ask for help. I was the top guy. And you have to ask for everything. You don't want to be the best shape of life asking for someone to put deodorant on. It's very hard to adjust. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been crazy, but we're gonna keep going. We have to show everybody what we are about.
Tell everybody, just describe to everybody listening the concept of PMA.
Yeah, I call every day. I call it a PMA, a positive mental attitude. Like right now, I have radiation voice. I'm getting over and medications, but I have to take them because that's the way it goes. You got to get over it. Do the best thing and be an advocate for yourself. So always take care of what you have to do, but always help others too.
So tell me about how you even got into PMA.
It's been a lot from way back. I read about it, and I had laying in the bed recliner. I had to do some reading to keep my mind off things because everything was, at the time, my diagnosis, it was, you know, we were given what? 11 months?
Yeah, it wasn't very much, maybe 14 months, yeah.
Yeah, they said I was going to be paralyzed. They said I'd never be able to move. And I was going to live in the hospital until I basically died.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it out in 17 days.
Mm-hmm.
When I did that, I said, I can do anything. I can keep going. And I need to start helping others so they can also have inspiration and a positive mental attitude every day. Every day.
So I read that book recently, the one that Nick is referring to, just to kind of wrap my head around the concept too. And basically, you have everybody has two choices. We can get up and think positive and choose to start the day and continue the day that way or not, right? Mm-hmm. And it's human to go through both of those ranges of emotions, right? Like, we're not all going to be perfect and have great positive days, right? But I think that for Nick, it was almost like I have to be positive every day because if I don't, I'm going to go down this spiral and it's just not going to be a place that's going to be good to end up in. So he just sort of adopted that positive mental attitude mentality through the whole cancer journey. And so when I read that book, I was like, all right, well, let's just see what this is all about. And it really is a very interesting concept, one that's obviously centuries old, this whole idea of your mind controlling your actions, controlling your feelings, and at least maybe not control, maybe that's not the right word, but helping you deal with a lot of things, right? So if you tell your mind, it's going to be a good day, it may not be a perfectly good day. That, you know what I mean? Like, it's just not going to be. But especially if you're in traffic in Chicago, but like, you know what I mean? But if you say that to yourself, and maybe you have to repeat it to yourself several times. And I have to do this all the time because I fall down that spiral a lot. But when you say to yourself, like, it's going to be okay. This is not the end of the world. I can make it through today. I just want to make it through today. And then I'll deal with it again, you know, deal with whatever comes tomorrow. Like, let's be positive today and see how that goes. And that positivity, it does radiate. It really does. Not everybody's going to accept it, but some people really do. And they'll give that positivity right back to you.
Yeah.
And that is a really cool feeling. Like, yes, when you radiate that positivity and then receive it from somebody else, there's nothing like it. Honestly, there is nothing like it. So that's kind of what helped him. And then eventually me, when I read the book, get through the dark days, because there are dark days and you just have to, like today, we were stuck in traffic. Like, you're stuck in traffic all the time, right? But Nick was just like, oh my gosh, this traffic. And I said, you know, it's actually not that bad. Like, we've been in worse, right? Like, it was raining, but I'm like, we've been in worse. Like, this could be snow. It could be worse. It's going to be snow in a couple months. Like, fine, let's just figure out something to talk about. And then that was it. Like, the entire attitude in the car changed. So something as simple as that, for somebody going through life or death, a journey that is life or death, makes a really big difference.
It's an incredible story. It's an awful, awful disease. And Diane, you using your platform to document Nick's journey and your journey, because you are definitely in it together, is definitely an inspiring thing. Let's get some donations. She's at ABC 7, so let's get some donations with the number 7 in there.
There we go.
$107, $7, $17,
$7,000.
$7,000
would be nice.
Yeah.
Let's, 7 million.
7 million.
Let's do it.
I love it. Text CURE24 to 41444, CubsForACure. .com. Diane has she's been involved with the ABTA. We've talked about Brain Up together. You're doing great stuff to tell Nick's story. And Nick, keep on keeping on, man. You're doing awesome. And thank you both so much. I know it was a very long day. I know those days well. So the fact that you logged into this Zoom and came on to tell your story during the Cubs for a Cure Radiothon, it means a lot to a lot of people, including me. So thank you so much.
Well, right back at you. Thanks for having us. We really appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your story and your brother's journey. And we just hope that you raise a lot of money and more to come. Honestly, more to come. Thank you so much for having us.
Keep that PMA. Let's go.
That's right.
Keep that PMA. Absolutely. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Diane. That's Diane Pathew from Channel 7 and her husband, Nick. We're over $325,000.
Let's go.
Not bad. Not bad. Let's keep it going with the Night Owls here. Your 20 becomes 40. Your 50 becomes 100. We got some Cubs charities, dollar for dollar matches that we still have to get to. We're over 1,250 individual donations that have been made. Why Brain Up is a good cause, why science and research matters. Our next guest in studio, Dr. Karan Dixit, he is executing the most recent clinical trial funded by Brain Up. He joins us in studio next. Cubs for a Cure Radiothon on the Score.
We're back live with more of the Cubs for a Cure Radiothon, benefiting cancer research in partnership with Stand Up to Cancer and Brain Up.
Hi, this is Elise Meniker, and I stand for family and friends. Thank you for supporting Cubs for a Cure.
Donate now by texting the phrase CURE24 to 41444. That's CURE24 to 41444.
And we've crossed $325,000. Do not let, you know, the midday and afternoon people tell you that nighttime people cannot donate. Let's go. It's evening. It's after dinner. You've had a couple of cocktails. Turn your 20 into 40.
Yeah, probably just got off work not too long ago, too, for some of you. You are awake. You are alert. You are ready to give, ready to take part.
The goal of this weekend is $1 million for cancer research. We want to get as close as we can with just this radiothon. So let's do it. CubsForACure.com. Text CURE24 to 41444. And so I'm on the board of directors of Brain Up. Crane Kenny introduced me to Brain Up when my brother was still alive. Brad attended a 5K at Brain Up, which is their big fundraising event of the year. The next one is September 21st. So you could register for that at brainup.ngo. And I've learned more about it. Dan and Meg Kresak were in earlier. Basically, we raise money and we have a medical advisory board and we fund clinical research. We fund research trials. And but so basically, Chicago area hospitals kind of they pitch us proposals. And then I don't know. But we have a medical advisory board from doctors from all over the country.
They're not trusting you to make these decisions.
Correct. So yeah, MD Anderson, UCLA, we were all over the country that are on our board that volunteer their time. And they basically say, good idea, bad idea. And sometimes we don't get good enough ideas, and so we don't fund any of it. But sometimes if we do, we allocate some money for research. And so the most recent recipient of the Brain Up Research Grant is being executed by Dr. Karan Dixit, and he keeps saying, just call me Karan, so I'm going to do that, but I wanted the audience to know, Karan, that we're on a first-name basis. That's okay?
Yep.
Okay. He's an assistant professor of neuro-oncology at the Malnati Brain Tumor Institute, which is where Brad, my brother, went under, had his cancer care. We had Dr. Heimberger and Dr. Stoop in studio earlier, so you are in very good company. Karan, thank you for joining us. I know it's been a long day.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here.
Yeah, you did rounds today. You had a full day, correct?
Full day, yeah.
Okay, so thank you for stopping in before you go home. Before we get into the specifics of what you're about to do, research, the value of it, why it's not funded as much as it should be for brain cancer. People are donating here. Why is it a worthwhile cause?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the disease is so devastating. The challenges and, you know, one of the reasons that there may not be enough funding opportunities is because they're rare diseases. But, you know, ultimately, the way I think about it is, despite how rare something is, it really impacts people. It impacts whole families. And so we're making advances. The way I think about it is we really want to treat people. We want to make people live longer, but we also want to make people live better. And we need to be able to study that in a nice, scientific, systematic fashion. And, you know, funding helps with that. You know, ultimately, that's what it is. And the more opportunities we have as scientists, as clinicians, as doctors all around the world, we collaborate together. Hopefully we can find better ways, you know, to help people with these devastating diseases.
What is it that makes specifically brain cancer so unique, so intricate in the way that it can be really difficult to treat? And we were just talking to a guest a little while ago, even difficult to diagnose initially.
It's the brain. You know, the brain is such a widely connected organ. You know, one of the things is the brain can really handle quite a bit until it can't, which is why, you know, when they're found, they're often larger than we think. There are multiple areas and, you know, the human body, the human brain is really a remarkable organ. But when it hits that inflection point is when people, you know, come to the hospital, they see doctors. And then when they're found, this is where the brain is a very, very, what we say, a connected network where some parts of the brain cannot be operated on. You know, these tumors often invade the brain tissue. And the brain is very important. So we have to do safe surgeries. And when these tumors, unfortunately, can never be removed surgically completely, then we have chemotherapies and radiation, medical therapies. And they work, but they only work to a certain degree. And that's kind of where, you know, some of the work that us and colleagues, like I said, all over the world are doing, hopefully finding better ways to treat these diseases. And the brain is just very hard to work with.
And I mean, I'm trying to get better at it, but I mean, there's ultrasound stuff now that people think is kind of encouraging a little bit, catheters that you can insert into the brain to basically do targeted medication. Like, it's kind of sad that the Stupp protocol is still the standard of care for glioblastoma, and it was, you know, medically approved in 2002. You're laughing, but I mean, there is some progress, or at least some optimism out there.
Yeah, I wasn't even in medical school then, and we're still using the same regimen. And you know, the other part of the brain is just it's behind a very protected network. So finding unique ways to get drugs where they need to go, the ultrasound, getting catheters, just to kind of get drug to be delivered appropriately into the brain tissue. You know, the brain's very well protected for good reason, but that stops drugs from getting in as well.
Yeah, and I mean, listen. The cure is the ultimate goal, but improved quality of life, I can't tell you what it would have meant to my brother and all of us if the tumor, when it came back, it was on his optic nerve and he went blind.
Yeah.
It was devastating. I mean, devastating that he knew what was going on and was alive but couldn't see his wife, couldn't see his kids, right? It was devastating. Then he's not able to walk. So now he's in a bed in his living room. You know, it's just like, oh my God, like this is not a quality of life. It's not what anybody would want. So yes, cure ultimate goal, but improved quality of life is obviously an incredibly worthy goal of science. So again, this is all going to research. Cubsforacure.com, text cure 24 to 41444. So this is going to be over our heads. It's going to be over our audience's head, so please speak to us like, you know, I mean, Ant's a football player, so I mean, real, speak slowly. Sorry. But, like, what are you studying with this research grant from BrainUp? What is the clinical trial that you are about to start enrolling patients in?
You know, and this is a partnership. You know, anything that I'm talking about is really kind of a huge group of people who've done a lot of great work. Dr. Atik Ahmed from the Northwestern lab. At all, kind of the idea, any idea that we bring to the clinic to bring to people is ultimately born out of a really good idea from the lab. And the idea basically is cancers, they want to grow. And you give chemotherapy and they find a way, we call that plasticity. And you give chemotherapy, the tumor sense that, you know, you're trying to kill it. And then it tries to drive these mechanisms, these other ways to try to survive basically. And based on some of the work that he did, looking at single tumor cells, looking at the genetic material, they found that a specific pathway was increased as a response to giving chemotherapy. And then when we find these pathways, the question is, well, if this pathway is increased, what can we do to potentially stop this resistance to chemotherapy? And you find drugs. And one of the compounds that was discovered is an agent that's being studied in other cancer types. So our clinical trial is, the basic of it is, we're combining the chemotherapy that we've been using since Dr. Stoop's regimen, and we're combining it with this new agent. The drug is called triapine. This is the first time we're combining it with temozolomide for this for glioblastoma that have grown back. It's the first time the oral formulation of the drug has been used, so there's a lot of unique things about the drug, and you know, we're really grateful for the support that BrainUp has shown us. I mean, ultimately, without the support, the study would not be a reality. So, we really appreciate all the you know, help that you guys have given us.
How does the process go to get something from the idea stage to the clinical trial stage before it's actually FDA approved? There's a lot of hoops to jump through.
Oh my
right?
God. Yeah. Oh, yeah. How long do you have?
Yeah. Well, I guess that could be the whole radiothon. you know, it takes years and years. I mean, the concept, I remember the first meeting we had was pre-COVID maybe, or the beginnings of COVID, where, you know, we just met, you know, and ideas there like, hey, we have this mechanism, we have this thing, and we learned that this is a way that these cancer cells become resistant. This is maybe a candidate drug that we can try. And then we work in collaboration with our scientists. Okay, well, let's try to get this drug. A lot of it's hustling, just finding, you know, we're trying to find free drugs somewhere and you got to pay for everything. Then, you know, it took years to do more science. You know, we have to prove, does it get into the brain? That's one thing. We got to make sure it's not killing mice unnecessarily. You know, before we ever go to human being, safety is always very important. The last thing we ever want to do is give any human being a compound that is unsafe. So right now, the study is currently in an early phase, which is where we're studying safety in combination with this chemotherapy, ultimately with a goal to bring it to people who have glioblastoma at the initial diagnosis.
Right now you're with recurrences.
Recurrent disease, yeah.
Right.
Because we think that the more aggressive you are in the beginning, or the best treatment you have before tumor grows back, is the best shot you have at potentially curing the disease. And so that's kind of the ultimate goal. But before we can do that, we have to show that the combination is safe. And that's kind of what an early phase or a phase one study is, showing the combination together is reasonable to give. And then it advances to higher dose levels. Then we show, hey, this is actually working. And then we bring it to a population, you know, a different population as well. And we show, hey, this is actually better than what we used to do. I can show Dr. Stoop maybe, hey, this regimen's better. That'll be amazing. I won't name it after myself, though. he doesn't either. He's humble enough to not call it that.
We call it the Stoop protocol.
Yeah. And then, you know, that's ultimately how drugs get through. We show the FDA, hey, this combination is better than what we used to do. Show safety, show efficacy, and then, you know, we can pat ourselves on the back. It's a long way to go.
Dr. Karin Dixit, assistant professor at neuro-oncology at the Malnati Brain Tumor Institute right here at Northwestern University, one of the best brain cancer hospitals in the world, the recipient of this last BrainUp research grant that is just starting right now. It's really incredible stuff. A couple hours ago, it was recorded, but one of your patients was on, Sri Rao, who our audience knows. He's been a longtime supporter of the station, a big listener. Our biggest hour so far was the 5 o'clock hour. Edrington, his company, put up a $15,000 match. Tom Ricketts, the owner of the Cubs, came in with a $25,000 match in that hour. It was incredible. So I know there's doctor-patient things that you wouldn't reveal if he hadn't said it earlier, but we talked about this. So my brother gets this diagnosis, and I'm like, oh my God, glioblastoma, Bo Biden, John McCain, terminal brain cancer. Like, and it's a rare form of cancer. Then my buddy Sri gets the CNS, central nervous system lymphoma.
Yeah.
And you look up the numbers on this thing, and he tells me about this treatment that he's going in now. He texted me today saying, you know, I'm glad we recorded this. I'm in the stage of this treatment where I can't even speak. You know, I can listen to the radiothon, and I'm texting you, but he can't even speak. You're his doctor. There's no funding for that, right?
Yeah.
It's so rare.
Yeah.
But the hope is, if I'm understanding this correctly, that the basic science, studying the brain, studying brain, maybe something like that could develop because, I mean, that's just a brutal diagnosis and it affects so few people that literally no one is funding research for it.
Yeah, that's
crazy.
That's one of the challenges. I mean, the most common tumor we see is technically a rare disease. And so when we see other things, they're even more rare. You know, and, you know, he gave me some permission to talk. Of course, I want to maintain some, you know, privacy there. But yeah, for, you know, what we're dealing with, that incredibly rare. So rare that there's hard to get the right people, the right scientists involved. You know, even getting some basic samples to do studies on are very difficult. Finding right models to do studies, and these all take, you know, advanced science, you know, new techniques to isolate cells, learning different pathways. You know, our hope that ultimately, you know, as there's more interest and involvement in funding brain tumor research, that we're able to also focus on some of these more rare diseases, CNS lymphoma, low-grade glioma, all these, so many tumors. But my hope ultimately is that, you know, with his help, that we can really, you know, advance some interest. And, you know, personally, maybe I'm biased, but it'd be great to get some funding to develop a strong research program there, because I think that's something, it's a population of people we can really help. And that's what we want to do. We really want to help. And we just need, you know, people's help, you know, people's support. And I think we can do it together.
Wondering from your experience, it seems to me, at least in my experience with family, with loved ones, there's either of two extremes where some people, when they get the cancer diagnosis, are very eager to do everything plausible to treat it. Some people very fearful of what chemotherapy could mean and how that could impact them. How much of that do you run into? And do you see the patient end of it evolving as treatments evolve, where maybe people are less apprehensive to get to dive deep into it?
No, I think that's an excellent question. And it's actually a question that we as a research group are trying to answer in a very specific population of people, young people like us who have certain brain cancers. They're called lower grade gliomas. And, you know, when you know, people that are young in the prime of their lives, lawyers, attorneys, athletes, and they get this diagnosis, and it's not a rapidly fatal disease like a glioblastoma, but it changes the course of their life. And, you know, to answer that, in the beginning of the diagnosis, it's hard to kind of conceptualize that there's something that there's a finite time.
Yeah.
But then through the course of the disease, you know, as there's more neurologic issues or when we have to talk about treatment, you know, some of those ideas come in. And the way we discuss, the way we have to counsel people and families through these difficult times, I think that's something that, you know, that we, that's our job. You know, the way I think about it is our job is not to give chemotherapy. That's just one aspect of what we do. It's really to help counsel families and patients, you know, through this. And so you're absolutely right. There's that gamut. I think it's important for us as oncologists to respect the sense that we get from the family. Some people want to be hyper aggressive, and that's kind of our job, is to have the knowledge, have the skill set to provide hyper aggressive treatment for anyone who wants it. When it makes sense, right? You know, we're going to give chemotherapy if it's going to cause too many problems, but also to be, you know, mindful if someone says, you know, this is kind of what's happened, and this is the time where I think my quality of life is so impacted, where there's not much role for more treatment. It's important for us to have a plan for that as well. Our goal is to make people live better, and that includes chemotherapy, but includes other ways of managing people as well.
Dr. Dixit, thank you for your lifetime of dedication to this disease. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And again, thank you for all the support given us. Thanks for Brain Up, and going to give us a guest some money soon.
All right. There we go. Dr. Karin Dixit at Northwestern. We will be back with the Cubs for a Cure Radiothon right here on The Score.
We're back live with more of the Cubs for a Cure Radiothon, benefiting cancer research in partnership with Stand Up to Cancer and Brain Up.
Hi, this is Elise Meniker, and I stand for family and friends. Thank you for supporting Cubs for a Cure.
Donate now by texting the phrase CURE24 to 41444. That's CURE24 to 41444.
And we've crossed $325,000. Do not let, you know, the midday and afternoon people tell you that nighttime people cannot donate. Let's go. It's evening. It's after dinner. You've had a couple of cocktails. Turn your 20 into 40.
Yeah, probably just got off work not too long ago, too, for some of you. You are awake. You are alert. You are ready to give, ready to take part.
The goal of this weekend is $1 million for cancer research. We want to get as close as we can with just this radiothon. So let's do it. CubsForACure.com. Text CURE24 to 41444. And so I'm on the board of directors of Brain Up. Crane Kenny introduced me to Brain Up when my brother was still alive. Brad attended a 5K at Brain Up, which is their big fundraising event of the year. The next one is September 21st, so you could register for that at brainup.ngo. And I've learned more about it. Dan and Meg Krisak were in earlier. Basically, we raise money, and we have a medical advisory board, and we fund clinical research. We fund research trials. And so basically, Chicago area hospitals kind of they pitch us proposals. And then I don't know. But we have a medical advisory board from doctors from all over the country.
They're not trusting you to make these decisions.
Correct. So yeah, MD Anderson, UCLA, we were all over the country that are on our board that volunteer their time. And they basically say, good idea, bad idea. And sometimes we don't get good enough ideas, and so we don't fund any of it. But sometimes if we do, we allocate some money for research. And so the most recent recipient of the Brain Up Research Grant is being executed by Dr. Karin Dixit, and he keeps saying, just call me Karin, so I'm going to do that, but I wanted the audience to know, Karin, that we're on a first-name basis. That's okay?
Yep.
Okay. He's an assistant professor of neuro-oncology at the Malnati Brain Tumor Institute, which is where Brad, my brother, had his cancer care. We had Dr. Heimberger and Dr. Stoop in studio earlier, so you are in very good company. Karin, thank you for joining us. I know it's been a long day.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here.
Yeah, you did rounds today. You had a full day, correct?
Full day, yeah.
Okay, so thank you for stopping in before you go home. Before we get into the specifics of what you're about to do, research, the value of it, why it's not funded as much as it should be for brain cancer. People are donating here. Why is it a worthwhile cause?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the disease is so devastating. You know, the challenges and, you know, one of the reasons that there may not be enough funding opportunities is because they're rare diseases. But, you know, ultimately, the way I think about it is, despite how rare something is, it really impacts people. It impacts whole families. And so we're making advances. The way I think about it is we really want to treat people. We want to make people live longer, but we also want to make people live better. And we need to be able to study that in a nice, scientific, systematic fashion. And, you know, funding helps with that. You know, ultimately, that's what it is. And the more opportunities we have as scientists, as clinicians, as doctors all around the world, we collaborate together. Hopefully, we can find better ways, you know, to help people with these devastating diseases.
What is it that makes specifically brain cancer so unique, so intricate in the way that it can be really difficult to treat? And we were just talking to a guest a little while ago, even difficult to diagnose initially.
It's the brain. You know, the brain is such a widely connected organ. You know, one of the things is the brain can really handle quite a bit until it can't, which is why, you know, when they're found, they're often larger than we think. There are multiple areas. And, you know, the human body, the human brain is really a remarkable organ. But when it hits that inflection point is when people, you know, come to the hospital, they see doctors. And then when they're found, this is where the brain is a very, very, what we say, a connected network where some parts of the brain cannot be operated on. You know, these tumors often invade the brain tissue. And the brain is very important. So we have to do safe surgeries. And when these tumors, unfortunately, can never be removed surgically completely, then we have chemotherapies and radiation, medical therapies. And they work, but they only work to a certain degree. And that's kind of where, you know, some of the work that us and colleagues, like I said, all over the world are doing, hopefully finding better ways to treat these diseases. And the brain is just very hard to work with.
And I mean, I'm trying to get better at it, but I mean, there's ultrasound stuff now that people think is kind of encouraging a little bit. Catheters that you can insert into the brain to basically do targeted medication. Like, it's kind of sad that the Stupp protocol is still the standard of care for glioblastoma, and it was, you know, medically approved in 2002. You're laughing.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is some progress, or at least some optimism out there.
Yeah, I wasn't even in medical school then, and we're still using the same regimen. And, you know, the other part of the brain is just it's behind a very protected network. So finding unique ways to get drugs where they need to go, the ultrasound, getting catheters, just to kind of get drug to be delivered appropriately into the brain tissue. You know, the brain's very well protected for good reason, but that stops drugs from getting in as well.
Yeah, and I mean, listen, the cure is the ultimate goal,
yeah.
But improved quality of life, I can't tell you what it would have meant to my brother and all of us if the tumor, when it came back, it was on his optic nerve and he went blind.
Yeah.
It was devastating. I mean, devastating that he knew what was going on and was alive, but couldn't see his wife, couldn't see his kids, right? It was devastating. Then he's not able to walk. So now he's in a bed, in his living room. You know, it's just like, oh my God, like this is not a quality of life. It's not what anybody would want. So yes, cure, ultimate goal, but improved quality of life is obviously an incredibly worthy goal of science. So again, this is all going to research. CubsForACure.com, text CURE24 to 41444. So this is going to be over our heads. It's going to be over our audience's heads. So please speak to us like, you know, I mean, Ant's a football player. So yeah. I mean, real, speak slowly. Sorry. But like, what are you studying with this research grant from BrainUp? Like what is the clinical trial that you are about to start enrolling patients in?
You know, and this is a partnership. You know, anything that I'm talking about is really kind of a huge group of people who've done a lot of great work. Dr. Atika Med from the Northwestern lab. At all, kind of the idea, any idea that we bring to the clinic to bring to people is ultimately born out of a really good idea from the lab. And the idea basically is cancers, they want to grow. And you give chemotherapy and they find a way, we call that plasticity. And you give chemotherapy, the tumor sense that, you know, you're trying to kill it. And then it tries to drive these mechanisms, these other ways to try to survive, basically. And based on some of the work that he did, looking at single tumor cells, looking at the genetic material, they found that a specific pathway was increased as a response to giving chemotherapy. And then when we find these pathways, the question is, well, if this pathway is increased, what can we do to potentially stop this resistance to chemotherapy? And you find drugs. And one of the compounds that was discovered is an agent that's being studied in other cancer types. So our clinical trial is the basic of it is we're combining the chemotherapy that we've been using since Dr. Stupp's regimen, and we're combining it with this new agent. The drug is called triapine. This is the first time we're combining it with temozolomide for this for glioblastoma that have grown back. It's the first time the oral formulation of the drug has been used. So there's a lot of unique things about the drug. And, you know, we're really grateful for the support that BrainUp has shown us. I mean, ultimately, without the support, the study would not be a reality. So we really appreciate all the, you know, help that you guys have given us.
How does the process go to get something from the idea stage to the clinical trial stage before it's actually FDA approved? There's a lot of hoops to jump
through. Oh my God. Yeah. How long do you have?
Yeah. I guess that could be the whole radiothon. you know, it takes years and years. I mean, the concept, I remember the first meeting we had was pre-COVID maybe, or the beginnings of COVID, where, you know, we just met, you know, and ideas there like, hey, we have this mechanism, we have this thing. And we learned that this is a way that these cancer cells become resistant. This is maybe a candidate drug that we can try. And then we work in collaboration with our scientists. Okay, well, let's try to get this drug. A lot of it's hustling, just finding, you know, we're trying to find free drugs somewhere and you got to pay for everything. Then, you know, it took years to do more science. You know, we have to prove, does it get into the brain? That's one thing. We got to make sure it's not killing mice unnecessarily. You know, before we ever go to human being, safety is always very important. The last thing we ever want to do is give any human being a compound that is unsafe. So right now, the study is currently in an early phase, which is where we're studying safety in combination with this chemotherapy, ultimately with a goal To bring it to people who have glioblastoma at the initial diagnosis.
Because right now you're with recurrences.
Recurrent disease, yeah.
Right.
Because we think that the more aggressive you are in the beginning, or the best treatment you have before tumor grows back, is the best shot you have at potentially curing the disease. And so that's kind of the ultimate goal. But before we can do that, we have to show that the combination is safe. And that's kind of what an early phase or a phase one study is, showing the combination together is reasonable to give. And then it advances to higher dose levels. Then we show, hey, this is actually working. And then we bring it to a population, a different population as well. And we show, hey, this is actually better than what we used to do. I can show Dr. Stoop maybe, hey, this regimen's better. That'd be amazing. I won't name it after myself, though. he doesn't either. He's humble enough to not call it that.
We call it the Stoop protocol.
Yeah. And then, that's ultimately how drugs get through. We show the FDA, hey, this combination is better than what we used to do. Show safety, show efficacy, and then, we can pat ourselves on the back. It's a long way to go.
Dr. Karin Dixit, assistant professor at neuro-oncology at the Malnati Brain Tumor Institute right here at Northwestern University, one of the best brain cancer hospitals in the world, the recipient of this last Brain Up research grant that is just starting right now. It's really incredible stuff. A couple hours ago, it was recorded, but one of your patients was on, Sri Rao, who our audience knows. He's been a longtime supporter of the station, a big listener. Our biggest hour so far was the 5 o'clock hour. Edrington, his company, put up a $15,000 match. Tom Ricketts, the owner of the Cubs, came in with a $25,000 match in that hour. It was incredible. So I know there's doctor-patient things that you wouldn't reveal if he hadn't said it earlier, but we talked about this. So my brother gets this diagnosis, and I'm like, oh, my God, glioblastoma, Bo Biden, John McCain, terminal brain cancer. And that's a rare form of cancer. Then my buddy Sri gets the CNS, central nervous system lymphoma.
Yeah.
And you look up the numbers on this thing, and he tells me about this treatment that he's going to now. He texted me today saying, I'm glad we recorded this. I'm in the stage of this treatment where I can't even speak. I can listen to the radiothon, and I'm texting you, but he can't even speak. There is, you're his doctor, there is no funding for that, right?
Yeah.
It's so rare.
Yeah.
But the hope is, if I'm understanding this correctly, that the basic science, studying the brain, maybe something like that could develop because, that's just a brutal diagnosis and it affects so few people that literally no one is funding research for it.
Yeah, that's
crazy.
That's one of the challenges. The most common tumor we see is technically a rare disease. And so when we see other things, they're even more rare. He gave me some permission to talk. Of course, I want to maintain some, privacy there. But yeah, for, what we're dealing with that, incredibly rare. So rare that there's hard to get the right people, the right scientists involved. Even getting some basic samples to do studies on are very difficult. Finding right models to do studies. And these all take, advanced science, new techniques to isolate cells, learning different pathways. Our hope that ultimately, as there's more interest and involvement in funding brain tumor research, that we're able to also focus on some of these more rare diseases, CNS lymphoma, low-grade glioma, so many tumors. But my hope ultimately is that, with his help, that we can really, advance some interest. And, personally, maybe I'm biased, but it'd be great to get some funding to develop a strong research program there, because I think that's something, it's a population of people we can really help. And that's what we want to do. We really want to help. And we just need, people's help, people's support. And I think we can do it together.
Wondering from your experience, it seems to me, at least in my experience with family, with loved ones, there's either of two extremes where some people, when they get the cancer diagnosis, are very eager to do everything plausible to treat it. Some people very fearful of what chemotherapy could mean and how that could impact them. How much of that do you run into? And do you see the patient end of it evolving as treatments evolve, where maybe people are less apprehensive to dive deep into it?
No, I think that's an excellent question. And it's actually a question that we as a research group are trying to answer in a very specific population of people, young people like us who have certain brain cancers. They're called lower grade gliomas. And when people that are young in the prime of their lives, lawyers, attorneys, athletes, and they get this diagnosis. And it's not a rapidly fatal disease like a glioblastoma, but it changes the course of their life. And, you know, to answer that, in the beginning of the diagnosis, it's hard to kind of conceptualize that there's something that there's a finite time.
Yeah.
But then through the course of the disease, you know, as there's more neurologic issues or when we have to talk about treatment, you know, some of those ideas come in. And the way we discuss, the way we have to counsel people and families through these difficult times, I think that's something that, you know, that we, that's our job. You know, the way I think about it is our job is not to give chemotherapy. That's just one aspect of what we do. It's really to help counsel families and patients, you know, through this. And so you're absolutely right. There's that gamut. I think it's important for us as oncologists to respect the sense that we get from the family. Some people want to be hyper aggressive, and that's kind of our job, is to have the knowledge, have the skill set to provide hyper aggressive treatment for anyone who wants it. And when it makes sense, right? You know, yeah. We're going to give chemotherapy if it's going to cause too many problems, but also to be, you know, mindful if someone says, you know, this is kind of what's happened, and this is the time where I think my quality of life is so impacted, where there's not much role for more treatment. It's important for us to have a plan for that as well. Mm. Our goal is to make people live better, and that includes chemotherapy, but includes other ways of managing people as well.
Dr. Dixit, thank you for your lifetime of dedication to this disease. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And again, thank you for all the support given us. Thanks for Brain Up, and going to give us a guest some money soon.
All right. There we go. Dr. Karin Dixit at Northwestern. We will be back with the Cubs for a Cure Radiothon right here on The Score.
O'Reilly. Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly.